Kid Porphyry was one of the group usually lumped together as the Cambridge Spies, the group that included the notorious Kim Philby, men who were recruited by the Soviets while at university, then left to make their mark in government departments. Moles, and in some cases moths, in sensitive wardrobes. When they ran to Mother Russia, they caused a huge scandal. Well, it was at that time. Nowadays, ho-hum, ancient history, and who the hell would he tell anyway? Not a soul would be interested anymore. Porphyry must have been the youngest of the lot. Well, Kit was the only one left alive, and that was certain. The others all gone, leaving a footnote, or at best a short chapter, in the secret history books. Especially nowadays, when the television provided most people with their news, tucking away the sound bite in the two-minute story, reducing history to the level of a cartoon. Except when it turned on you and slugged you in the guts. As Charlie took another quick look, he noticed that Kit's hair was still in good condition, still long and flopping around his ears, and that he had a healthy tan on the weather-beaten face, his eyes not leaving the woman he appeared to be with, lips smiling, moving, and tipping flattery onto the reddish-blonde head. Oh, Kit, you were always a charmer. In the circles in which Gauntlet had once moved, they rated Kit's charm at devastating +10. Storm warnings should be hoisted, they said, to warn virgins whenever he came into the room. Not that they needed warning in the current climate. In that split second, Charlie recalled everything. Hardly the blink of an eye, yet he plainly saw the old chief's office, 9th floor above the gasoline company in the now-vacated Century House. He'd been a child then, that Monday morning in the very late 60s, a time when swinging London was just starting to wind down. London, with Mary Quant, the Beatles, campaign for nuclear disarmament marches, Bieber, Twiggy, the Pill, and all the other icons of that turning era beginning to decelerate. Monday morning, and the two anoraks from the security service, their sisters, with whom they rarely shared anything, and a wax-skinned suit from the U.S. Embassy in Grosvenor Square who had brought the news. "Former buddy of yours, as we understand it," the American drawled. "My people in D.C. have asked him to leave. Hope you don't mind. They'll be putting him on a flight from Dulles tonight. Here's the collateral." The hand dipped into the pigskin document folder and came up with the photographs, which was spread out on the chief's desk. Old Kit Palfrey, meeting Krakilov, Gennady, First Secretary, Military, to the Soviet Embassy in Washington, D.C. The envelope slid across the table and pocketed. Caught in flagrante, after all the warnings the Yanks had given them from their huge building among the lush Virginia trees at Langley, or was it McLean? There was the photograph and a few straws in the wind. "We would suggest," the smooth suit continued, "that you give him a very hard interrogation. Sweat him. Get a The old chief's palm came down on the desk, flat and hard as his baby blue eyes. "I would be obliged if you'd refrain from trying to teach me my job," he yapped. "We've been doing this for the best part of 500 years, since the first Elizabeth, and you're stating the obvious, and not necessarily the best way to go about matters. Kit Porphyry is a senior officer of this service, and I've yet to see hard evidence." In many ways, the chief's outburst had a lot to do with the manner in which Porphyry was later to be treated. Nobody wanted to find him guilty. That was the top and bottom of it. "The photographs," the American began, "tell us nothing. How do I know they weren't cobbled together in one of your bucket shops? You've never liked him in D.C., and I'd be the first to admit that his drinking habits leave much to be desired. However, there's the possibility that Porphyry has a reasonable explanation." The American, who was called Ben Kemp, and whose rank in the real world was Colonel, let out a one-note contemptuous laugh, and one of the anoraks shook his head. "They told me you'd try to cover it up. Anything to keep it out of the papers. That's what they said at Langley." The chief sent him packing, and Charlie was dispatched to Heathrow with Gus Keane, head of interrogators. Passports at dawn and tired transatlantic commuters slewing off the early morning arrival. "Idiot yaks," Kit had said when they shook hands. "Bloody fools think I'm working for the Russians." "Are you?" Gus asked as they drove away. "Don't be daft, Augustus. Don't be a stupid brat." But Gus, with Charlie in tow, put him to the question. Very hostile Gus could be when he wanted. All week they interrogated Kit, with no results. Charming, relaxed Kit Porphyry laughed at them. Lunatic to even consider that he was tied up with the Reds. Bloody raving if they thought that. Barking. As for the Yanks' photograph of him with Krakiloff, well, the envelope was simply some snaps. It was all in the log. He'd been cozying up to Gennady in an attempt to turn and burn him. Could he sue the Americans for casting doubts on his loyalty? Christopher. Kit. Nobody ever calls me Christopher. Kit. Like Kit Marlowe. He was a spy as well, Kit Marlowe. Got himself stabbed, maybe for the same business, possibly for betrayal, or because of it. Or maybe that film was right and he died in a row about his bar bill. Who knew now? Come the Friday, Gus told the boss that they would carry on with the hostile questions on Monday. Had nothing as yet. So Kit Porphyry walked away from the beautiful 19th century house in Audley Street, where they did that kind of thing. Home for the weekend, according to the two special branch lads who had quietly followed him to the service apartments off Marylebone High Street. So they left him alone, and there were those who seemed surprised that, come Monday morning, he'd gone. The bird had flown. Gone, vamoosed, evaporated, dematerialized, done a bunk. 5 weeks later, Kit Palfrey resurrected himself in Moscow and immediately started to unbutton his lip about how he'd worked for the Sovs since days of yore. "I never drew a penny for my masters, the Soviets. Long ago I came to the conclusion the state of world politics demanded of me only one way, the way of communism after the manner of the Soviet Union. I have served that ideal to the best of my ability for a long time." At that point, Kit Porphyry entered the mythology, beginning a long and almost stately journey. Whenever they wrote books about the so-called Cambridge spies, they included Kit, and he was good value. He even wrote a kind of autobiography himself. A World of Secrets, it was called. And a thrusting, savvy publisher actually walked from his Bloomsburg office on a Friday night, flew to Moscow, picked up the manuscript, and was back on Monday morning with a great coup. Then the interest waned, and with the downfall of the old evil empire, it almost completely vanished. The Cold War was won. Nobody wanted to read about the secret world, treachery or betrayal anymore. Except for somewhat boring history books. Taste shifted. The act of selling your country down the river was devalued. The world turned, the Soviet system collapsed, and the lads of the CIA, SIS, MI5 and the rest sat down and toasted each other saying, "It's over, and we won. Hooray for us." Yet, what would Kit Porphyry be doing in London now? Had he sneaked in, taken the soft route via Dublin so he would not have to show his passport, or come skulking in via Paris on Eurostar? If they knew he was there, the men and women who worked in the supposedly anonymous building at Vauxhall Bridge Cross, would they care a damn? Would they shout for him to stand trial for treason, this Cold War criminal? Not Pygmalion likely. One thing was certain, two things as it turned out, Kit Porphyry Esquire should not have been in the United Kingdom, let alone London. The other point was that when the evening was done and the curtain had fallen on the heroine hurling herself from the clifftops and redeeming the fabled Flying Dutchman, Charlie Gauntlet, newly married, grinning from ear to ear and looking as though he'd been stunned by some cartoon frying pan, appeared to be quite unaware of Kit Porphyry's eyes on the back of his head, and oblivious to Kit Porphyry's mouth curved upward in a smile that was as sardonic as the call of a mockingbird. One thing he did notice, but only vaguely. On the edge of his vision, Charlie was suddenly aware of another figure from his past. There, and then gone, in a second, in the twinkling of an eye, really. As they walked out through the foyer, jostled shoulder to shoulder with the crowd, he caught sight of a tall, slim, seedily elegant figure moving quickly against the throng. He did not so much see Patsy Wright, once his link to those who did daring do, the fighting hands in the more dangerous European capitals, during the years when they crunched their way over the permafrost, as sense him, catch sight of his reflected silhouette against the skyline of the crowd. Charlie turned, frowning as they reached the street, his eyes searching behind him, trying to catch sight of his old comrade. There 1 minute, and gone the next. In the taxi, after the Dutchman's soul had found rest, following true love, Bex laid her head on Charlie's shoulder again and murmured, "He wasn't looking for you, was he?"
"Who? Looking for who?"
"Whom?"
"Whom? Looking for whom?"
"Kit Palfrey. He wasn't looking for you, was he?"
"You're not old enough to know Kit Palfrey."
"Don't change the subject. I'm not old enough to remember the events, but I'm old enough to read about them. What's more, only a few years ago, a handful of years, when the evil empire was still evil, we had an alert out on Mr. Palfrey. Some bright spark thought he was heading up some Russians who were feeding guns to terrorists."
"So you can read. Okay."
"Charlie, he wasn't looking for you, was he?"
"I shouldn't think so. I guess he hated my guts, really, though he had nobody who could break him. Not even old Gus Keane could sort him out. God knows we both tried."
Pause. Count of 10.
"No, I'd be very surprised if he was looking for me."
Which shows you just how wrong some people can be. Back in Dolphin Square, they did not know that their lives had been bisected by events long travelled. Each, in his and her way, was about to take up a new course, navigate to an undreamed-of bearing to plough a new furrow. Speaking of ploughing, the honeymoon continued, but was interrupted at a little after 2 in the morning, when they were both curved like spoons lying together in velvet, just reaching out for sleep. Bex cursed, fumbled for the telephone on its third ring, almost knocked over the glass of water, and whispered,
"Oleska,"
into the mouthpiece. "Sorry, ma'am," the voice at the distant end breathed. "The commander wants you in. Alchemist's active again." She cradled the instrument, swore under her breath, then slid unwillingly from the bed's warmth, gathered up her clothes and tiptoed to the bathroom. Bleary, she gave herself a quick wink in the mirror and started to wash. Feeling sexy in the wee small hours, would have given a bit of her pension to get back into bed and wake Charlie from his private dreamland. Instead, she left a note for him. "Sorry, my love, my husband, but duty calls. Commander Bain needs me back in the salt mines. See you when I see you. Love being married to you, Bex." And a couple of hugs and a kiss. O-X-O. So, Bex Gauntlet, nay Oleska, of the anti-terrorist branch, headed off to work, not knowing the call of duty meant she would miss the unscheduled meeting between her husband and Kit Palfrey, but at the moment she had other fish to fry. Alchemist, to name but several.